The Troubadour Tapes.
I had a goose and the goose pleased me.
Woman's only human.
One less set of footsteps on your floor.
Never saw my hometown till I stayed away.
The Troubadour Tapes.
Hi, thanks for listening to the Troubadour Tapes podcast. This is a monthly podcast where we ask a writer from the Troubadour magazine in San Diego and the subject of their article to hold the interview here at Berkeley Sound Studio. I'm Jeff Berkeley. This is the interview that will become one of the stories on the San Diego Troubadour pages, but you get to hear it live as it happens, in their own words. This week's interviewer is Steve Thorne. He's a very rare breed, a San Diego native. He's also a contributing writer to the San Diego Troubadour magazine, and he's been writing since 1971 when his review of Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story appeared in his high school magazine. Our guest this week is Michael Rennie.
I work for the Poway Center for the Performing Arts Foundation, which is an independent, not-for-profit, created by the city of Poway to book professional performances at the center.
But that's not the story here. Not really. I mean, he's great at that job, don't get me wrong. But there's a deeper reason for that. Like all of us, it's about where Michael Rennie comes from, where and when he grew up, studied and learned about life and art. If you came of age in the late 70s and 80s, like he did, like I did, this will be a trip down memory lane for you. If not, it's a great history lesson for what was going on around then musically and how a kid growing up in the time of New Wave and then the beginnings of the alternative music and the Southern college rock bands can end up right back at the beginning playing the songs of American troubadours, as well as country and rock idols from Dylan to Graham Parsons to Elvis Presley and Hank Snow.
Mr. Fineman, won't you please listen to me, cause I got a pretty mama in Tennessee, keep moving me on.
Probably best to start out with where Michael was born and raised.
Yeah. Newport Richey.
Where's that?
Newport Richey, Florida.
Newport Richey is in West Pasco County. It's just north of Tarpon Springs, Clearwater, St. Petersburg, so north of that area. My folks moved there in the early 70s from New Hampshire, so I'm a Northeasterner by birth. Like many people, they were just attracted to new life and inexpensive land and, you know, the promise of waking up every day to pluck an orange fresh from the tree and have fresh juice, I guess. And it was a great place to grow up as a kid. The weather's real mild. But as I say, there's not a lot going on in terms of arts and culture, at least not back in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up.
And you're holding your guitar, your first instrument of choice. Now, were you...
I'm holding Jeff Berkeley's guitar.
That's true, Jeff Berkeley's guitar. Now,
who?
Were you self-taught or did you have guitar lessons? How did you get rolling musically?
There was a woman at the church my family went to.
It always starts at church.
I think she heard me listening to a Dylan record and she said, you know, do you play guitar? Because she was an old hippie. And she played guitar, and so she started showing me how to play "Blowing in the Wind," and I thought, well, that's real cool, and that's how it got started. She showed me how to play a G, an E minor, a C, and a D, and probably for about 2 years, that's all I played, with increasing expertise. Somebody gave me a Dylan songbook, and those songs were real easy to learn for a beginning guitarist. And the thing that was so appealing about those stripped down Dylan songs is that when you listen to those recordings, My Back Page is Blowing in the Wind, Times They Are Changing, I mean, all of those early acoustic hits, you know, those are fully realized songs with just a guy and an acoustic guitar. And for a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, that was something of a revelation to hear that just one guy with an acoustic guitar could make music. So that was very appealing to me.
You grew up in the South during an interesting time where music was evolving. We had the Southern boogie bands, we had Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Endless Solos.
Oh,
but
yes.
You're coming of age at the time of college radio.
Oh, yeah.
And a Southern pop revolution that's happening with the likes of Big Star in Memphis, R.E.M. in Athens, Georgia.
Huge, yeah.
So that must have been a quite a tidal wave for you.
Yeah, I mean, what, growing up, the, you know, the hardcore Southern rock bands, Molly Hatchet, Outlaws, Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, that was the music of my high school parking lot, you know, with all of the ne'er-do-wells that image sometimes attaches itself to. And I wasn't really, you know, I wasn't really dialed into that scene. I love that stuff now, but at the time, it was not my gig. So yeah, it's funny you mentioned REM. I mean, I was right at that perfect age to latch on to the emerging college rock movement of the early 80s. REM being a Southern band, you know, that was just huge. It was interesting to have something of our own that wasn't Skynyrd. And yeah, I learned to play guitar off of early REM records. You know, I can still play arpeggios at rapid speed, just aping Peter Buck licks. So, you know, not only REM, but there were so many other sort of college rock bands at the time, Guadalcanal Diary, and of course the first Violent Femmes album loomed large in my world, a very stripped down acoustic based record. Big Star emerged as a kind of a popular band after their time in the early mid 80s. 10,000 Maniacs were coming out strong then. Of course, the Replacements were a huge influence at this time. Heavier bands like Husker Du. God, I could just go down the whole list of college rock staples from the 80s. The Smiths. You know, that was all the stuff that really expanded my guitar vocabulary, certainly. Very guitar-based music. And it was exciting because at that time, that was very underground music. When people look back at the 80s now, they have this sort of rose-colored reminiscence about it, thinking that the radio was just filled with, you know, Smith's records, and it just wasn't that way. That stuff was underground music at the time. You were part of a subculture if you, you know, if you had a TSOL t-shirt. President Reagan's been shoving.
Opinions expressed by True Sounds of Liberty are not necessarily the opinions of the San Diego Troubadour magazine or Berkeley Sound. Although, I have to admit, I was a TSOL fan. And now, a word from our sponsors.
They often receive a standing ovation for their sound checks.
No.
When they play the blues, B.B. King weeps. They once hit a high C in harmony and broke all the fine china in China.
I don't often attend concerts, but when I do, I prefer Citizen Band, the most interesting band in the world.
CitizenBandMusic.com.
The Troubadour Tapes.
If we back up and look at your resume a little bit, you do have a degree in journalism, but your minor from Florida at Gainesville was in theatrical arts, drama.
Right.
So what's... How did that sort of prepare you for what you're doing now musically and as an administrator?
Well, the University of Florida College of Journalism was really smart in that they required all of their journalism majors to have a minor, which I thought was really wise. They wanted people to know something about something, not just the art of journalism, but to also have an area of outside interest. And I'd always been interested in drama and theater.
Villain. Be sure thou prove my love a whore. Be sure of it.
Give me the ocular. As I told you when we met earlier in the week, I grew up in deep suburban Florida, as I like to call it. I grew up in an area called Newport Richey, Florida, which is, you know, 45 minutes outside of Tampa and half an hour from nowhere. And there were no cultural institutions there. There was really not an opportunity to see live music in my part of the world. And there was no live theater, no art galleries, you know, nothing like that. So when I went to Gainesville, in addition to finding a really vibrant, exciting band scene, as a student, I could go see theater for a quarter, and I would see Shakespeare, and I'd see Sam Shepard plays, I'd see Harold Pinter at plays, I'd see, you know, just fabulous works of theater for a quarter, and I didn't really think of it as participating in any sort of high culture. To me, it was just this incredibly new form of entertainment. So I latched onto that with a lot of fervor, and when it came time to choose my minor, I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to take electives, I want to take theater classes. And I'd take acting for non-major classes, and I would take film classes, and I took theater as literature classes, and before long, I found myself working in the theater with no real interest of getting on stage and acting. I mean, I was always a fan first. I was never an actor. despite the name.
Oh, right, right. We need to explain this for those of you who don't understand what we're talking about.
The name Michael Rennie, for a lot of people my age, we identify with this dashing British actor.
Yep, sorry to disappoint.
And we were wondering if you perhaps your parents named him after you, and you have some interesting stories about the Rennie connection anyway, about how people your age would know him.
Well, my parents claimed to have no connection. They just liked the name Michael, and they had the name Rennie, so that was that. Yeah, and, you know, I'm not a baby boomer. I'm kind of a borderline Gen Xer, a late baby boomer, So for me, my introduction to Michael Rennie was the local independent TV show or TV station would show The Day the Earth Stood Still a couple times a year. So being a, you know, what, 8-10-year-old kid at that time, it was really cool to see your name on the opening credits of a movie.
Klaatu.
Yeah, Klaatu Nictu Barata, something like that.
Oh, hey, there's Liz. She's the editor-in-chief of the San Diego Troubadour.
That was real cool in my preteen and teen years, but the real cachet of the Michael Rennie name came in my middle school years when my peers got turned on to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, very good.
And the big red lips came on the screen, and the first two words out of their mouths were Michael Rennie, and then they went on to say Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still. So that was my cachet of cool through the middle school and high school years.
Okay, cool. So that's just a little sidebar. We had to tell you guys. Some of you recognize the name. Anyway, back to the story. Michael's now hanging out in Gainesville, going to college, and he starts to check out the music scene.
Gainesville, if you're a young person in the Southeast and looking for a town to go cut your teeth on a band scene, that's the place to go. You know, some very noteworthy bands have come out of there. Obviously, Tom Petty looms large in the Gainesville legacy, but Against Me, who... I think some magazines gave them the distinction of Band of the Year a few years back. They're from Gainesville. Sister Hazel's from Gainesville. Who else is from Gainesville? Less Than Jake. We used to play house parties with Less Than Jake all the time. Great thing about a small scene like that is that you'd have a rock band on a bill with a ska band, on a bill with a folk singer, on a band with a heavy metal band, and nobody would blink an eye.
Let's talk about some of the bands you were in prior to coming to the West Coast in San Diego. Anyone that particularly stands out as a growing experience for you?
Certainly none that anybody listening or reading will remember. But you know, not to harp too much on it, but when I moved from Newport Richey to Gainesville, Florida, it was just a life changing experience for me. I call it my adopted hometown. It's a small, liberal Southern college town with a tremendous band scene. But even so, I was incredibly shy about joining bands. I didn't think I was a particularly good guitarist. I was the absolute best performer in my bedroom, and I would perform nightly for an audience of my own reflection. But after listening to that for the better part of a year, my roommate finally brought home a flyer from a local burrito shop and said, "You need to go join a band." And I did. And the band was called Bicycle Thieves, after the Italian film. And I was really dumbfounded by how easy it was to form a band and play and just have an absolute blast. I'd heard all the punks say, "Just go form a band, just go form a band." But I thought, no, it's got to be more complicated than that. But, you know, when you get four creative people in a room who just really want to write songs and perform for people, inevitably something's going to come out of it. And you do it long enough, something really good's going to come out of it. So my first band to this day is still the band that tugs at my heartstrings the most. We wrote very, very REM-influenced Southern college rock of the time, sounding songs, and played house parties and clubs and recorded a 5-song cassette. You know, this was what, 1989, so cassettes were still a dominant medium.
Yes,
for young bands, and sold 500 copies of our cassette in Gainesville, which just, you know, I thought that was as big a deal as one could ever hope for. And I have to imagine that every musician has a story like this. You know, your first band is like your first love. Everything's new and exciting and rewarding at a level you've never known before.
Indeed. Up next, Michael arrives in San Diego and starts to put down roots.
Their legend precedes them the way lightning precedes thunder.
No.
When they go for a dip in the ocean, mermaids appear. When it is raining, it is because they are singing a sad song.
I don't often attend concerts, but when I do, I prefer Citizen Band, the most interesting band in the world.
CitizenBandMusic.com.
The Troubadour Tapes.
And since you arrived in San Diego, you've been generally identifiable with two groups. And the first group is the first group I recall seeing you play, mm-hmm. and it was at International Pop Overthrow in Los Angeles.
Right.
And this would have been Roxy Monoxide, which was a power pop band in very much that 70s, 80s vein. And a little bit of glam thrown in, and always seemed to have attractive women singing in the band, too, as I recall.
That's true.
So let's talk a little bit about Roxy, because something's going to be happening to them in the next couple of days, sadly.
Yeah, I'm guessing by the time this comes out, they will have played their last show. But
that's true. It was December 18th.
Yeah, I started playing with Roxy Monoxide in 2003. I moved to town in 2000. I had just gotten married. You know, my career had jumped ahead a couple of steps. I was working for the Old Globe, which is, of course, a nationally renowned, internationally known theater company. And I was kind of going through a phase where I thought, you know, you're in your early mid-30s, rock bands are fun for kids, but, you know, you're going to have to give this up at some point, right? And that sentiment didn't really stick. You know, the guitars were in the corner, my wife was kind of nudging me, when are you going to take up the guitar again? So through the traditional media, online classifieds or whatnot, I connected with this band, Roxy Monoxide. Great songwriter, Scott Samuels, who writes these fantastic post-punk power pop songs, many of them rooted in kind of the Pretenders Blondie sound, but as you mentioned, with a lot of T-Rex and Sweet thrown in for good measure. This was the first time I played in a band where I wasn't fronting a band, so I got to be quote-unquote just the guitarist, which was wonderfully liberating, you know, just to focus on guitar tone and guitar execution and being that additional voice in the band was a lot of fun, and it was kind of right for where I was in my professional and personal life. I didn't have to quote unquote lead a band. I could just add additional flavor, I love playing with that band. I played with that band for 5 years until I got the itching to form the band I'm in currently. Still great friends with all of those people, and sad to say, they are going to play their last show this Saturday at Humphreys. I'm going to sit in with them for a couple of songs. Several people who had rotated through that band over the years are going to come out and have their featured moments. So, you know, hopefully, it'll be a fitting eulogy to a band that I think was kind of underappreciated locally. There aren't that many really. I shouldn't say this. I'm not aware of many really strong power pop bands locally, so to lose another one is, you know, it's a loss.
You're working at the Old Globe Theater.
Right.
And Liz and I, the Troubadour, have been laughing about this, but I know your job obviously involved much more than this, but it seems from the stories we've heard so far that you had sort of this audio complaint window going, where if people had a little bit of reservations toward maybe the language or the scenes in the film, or film in the play, you could be the sounding board for them to basically vent.
I was the guy. If somebody called I was the number two man in the marketing department. My most of my theater background up to this point was in marketing, and so I was the number two guy in the Globe marketing department. And one of my roles, this is not one of my major roles, but it probably yields the best stories. One of my roles was that if the box office got an irate customer that they just couldn't make happy, I was the guy that got that call. They would transfer that call upstairs to me. And I loved that role. I encouraged people to send those people to me, because it was a lot of fun to take somebody who was really irate about some little content issue. And if I did my job well, just kind of turn them around, bring them back to the family. And I got pretty good at it. You know, I kind of knew all of the typical things people would complain about. I didn't like the language. I didn't like seeing a part of a body that I don't usually see. You know, I didn't like this or that adult content. And for the most part, I was pretty decent at talking people off the ledge, as it were. But I'll never forget this one year. One time I got a call from the box office saying, we have a person complaining about the Trojan Women. One summer, the Globe had done this modern adaptation of the Trojan Women. And the Trojan Women is as gritty a Greek tragedy as you want. It's about the war between Greece and Troy, and it's got, you know, it's got murder, and it's got rape and incest, and it's got violence, and it's got sexuality, and it's just got the whole spate of objectionable content. So I had all of my arguments in place when I got the call. I mean, this is a play where a mother throws her baby over the wall to the invading troops. I mean, it's pretty intense, gritty Greek tragedy stuff. So this guy, I pick up the phone and I'm ready to address all of the concerns. And this guy says, well, listen, I saw that play. I understand you have a problem with it. Tell me what's on your mind. And I should step back a moment. The play was very formalized. It had elements of the ancient and it had elements of the modern, meaning that some of the characters would be wearing togas and crowns, and others would be wearing modern military outfits. You know, there would be castle walls and the sound of helicopters above. So again, a very, very formalized telling. So this guy gets on the phone. He says, look, you guys didn't say it in your play, but I know United States Army infantry uniforms, and those were U.S. armies that you those were U.S. infantrymen that you depicted in that play, and the things that you had them doing were just unacceptable to me. No infantrymen would ever behave the way those men acted. Well, of course, I didn't have any response to that, so I just sort of say, you know, you're right. I'm really sorry, and that was kind of it. You know, so often people just kind of want to, well, just kind of want to vent a little bit. And not to wax too poetic about this, but for me, it's really a testament to the impact of live theater, because people see all of this content in films all the time. They never call the movie theater to complain. I mean, they might walk out grousing. They may post negative things about it on their Facebook page. They may tell their friends not to go see a movie. But nobody ever calls a cinema and says, I can't believe you put, movie X on your screen. I'm so offended. I'll never come back. And I really wrestled with that for a while. I would get irate with customers. Why do you complain to us, but you don't complain to a movie theater? And again, I kind of take it as a compliment now. When people see other people in their space doing things, it affects them more profoundly than they do if they're sitting watching lights on a screen. So I choose to see it as a benefit of the medium. It clearly has a stronger impact on somebody when there's a real person in a room with them doing these things. Now, hopefully, the majority of those experiences are cathartic, life-changing, uplifting, whatnot. But, you know, even if it shakes you up a little bit, that's cool. I'll take it.
In the current band, Rio Peligroso.
Rio Peligroso.
And I pronounced that correctly.
You pronounced it with great
Rio
vigor and
Peligroso.
Flourish.
Okay. The name for the band, first of all, and your mission. What is your musical mission with Rio Peligroso?
So highbrow. I wanted to form a cover band that I really like. There were a lot of things that led to me forming this band. One was I was hiking with my wife in Sequoia National Park and just looking at the golden rolling hills and the sprawling live oaks, and just had this moment where I was just enamored with the whole Southern California, SoCal country rock. And I just wanted to, you know, wrap myself up in the ghost of Graham Parsons and sing bird songs all afternoon. And I just thought I could have so much fun doing that in a band. Wouldn't that be awesome? And at the same time, oddly enough, I was reading a lot of rock biographies, which is something I hadn't done much of in my life. But I just found myself 3-4 years ago reading rock biographies voraciously. And one of the things that really jumped out at me as I was reading these biographies is that all of the really great bands of the rock era, and I'm talking about, you know, your Beatles, your Stones, the Birds, the Who, all of those bands cut their teeth playing covers. And, the Beatles in the Cavern Club, the Stones with their blues, the Birds would play Roll Over Beethoven at clubs [S2] Sure. [S1] On the Sunset Strip, and so on. And I thought, you know, that's really something that musicians from my generation, I don't want to be too absolutist about this, but a lot of the musicians I knew kind of skipped that step. If you came of age in the post-punk era, it seemed like there was this incredible stigma to playing covers. It seemed like as soon as you could play three chords, you had to be writing songs and performing original music. And I get the nobility of that sentiment, but I think it also leads to a lot of musicians skipping an essential step in their development, namely learning from the masters, you know, learning your craft by learning the songs that, you know, by, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants. They're there. There's a catalog of music waiting to be learned. And a lot of musicians just skip that. And many musicians get along just great without ever having a cover phase. But a lot of people go straight from learning three chords to writing a lot of mediocre originals. And I raised my hand high. I was definitely one of those musicians. So I got really excited about this notion of going back and learning Birdsong, Hank Snow songs, you know, early Elvis tunes, you know, all of the staples of the country rock and country genre. But at the same time, having this kind of curatorial bent, I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could mix it up with, you know, alternative rock and country rock? So you'll hear us match up you know, a Camper Van Beethoven song with a Bird song, and go from a Hank Snow song into an early REM number. So I always wanted there to be this balance between old and new and obscure and semi-popular without ever being obvious. You know, I've said before in articles, you'll never hear us playing Brown Eyed Girl. We might play Into the Mystic, but you're not going to hear Brown Eyed Girl.
That's refreshing. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I wanted to create a band that I would go see.
Yes.
And, you know, it's very gratifying and a little intimidating because what it does is it draws out the music snobs in the crowd, like you and me. So when you get off stage, there'll be that guy at the back of the room making a beeline for you to quiz you on your particular choice of arrangement on Long Black Veil.
And like the British Invasion, where the Beatles so overwhelmed the scene that we sometimes forget about the other bands, the Kinks, the Zombies. Mm. The same with Southern California rock of the 70s. If you listen to FM radio, you would think that the only group that existed in God's green earth was, they were the Eagles.
Right.
You know, there was no other band. There was no Poco. Right. There was no Flying Burrito Brothers. Right, it was just right. The Eagles.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the mindset of radio, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But you are, with Real, allowing us to take the road less taken to hear these bands. Maybe some of the people in the audience are hearing for the first time. I'm hearing stuff from you that I have not played since college on my turntable.
Nice. Yes. I'm not sure what I can say to expand upon that, but yeah, that was always the, I mean, I fully embrace that there is a almost a musical snob component to what we do. We want to pick semi-esoteric songs, but at the same time, the formation of this band was also a tool to be able to play the types of venues that I couldn't play in all original bands. I mean, I have loved the gigs that I played at, you know, the Casbah or, gosh, what are some of the other indie clubs of record in our area?
O'Connell's,
sure. I've loved those venues, but there's a different vibe to the all original scene. It tends to be more of a, you know, people standing with arms folded, watching a band. And I get it. I've been that guy, you know. But I also had this romantic image of the proverbial gritty little roadhouse on the outskirts of town where, you know, people that don't really talk about music or load up on vinyl like you and I might just go to throw back a couple beers and shake their booties. And I thought, well, I want to play that venue. I don't get that experience playing in heady original bands. I want to play for a crowd that got off work at 5, cashed their paycheck, and headed to the bar to unwind at the end of the week. And yeah, a lot of original bands don't get that experience, so it's been a tremendous. I love that part of playing in Rio Peligroso, playing a joint like Pappy and Harriet's out in Joshua Tree, or even Hensley's up the road has a great great appreciation for the type of music we play. Humphrey's Backstage Lounge has been tremendously good to us, and you know, I love those venues.
All great San Diego venues indeed. Don't forget Cheers up in Ramona. Awesome roadhouses. They're like a gift from the rock and roll gods, I guess. Now, Michael mentioned Pappy and Harriet's. And Pappy and Harriet's is sort of the brigadoon of roots music venues to play. It's almost as if it appears from nowhere in the mist and gives you the most amazing night you've ever had. It's probably better if I just let Steve and Michael explain.
So how was Pioneer Town? Talk to our listeners about the Pioneer Town.
Doesn't everybody know about Pioneer Town by now? No? All right. Pappy and Harriet's was the place I had in mind when I formed this band, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention the exceptional talents that have supported this band. I started this band in 2008 with David Lizer-Bram, who has played in a number of local bands. Kite Flying Society. He brought along Todd Cachetta from Kite Flying Society, and those guys, along with myself, formed the core of that band for 2 years. So yeah, Pappy and Harriet's was the place I had in mind when I formed this band. I wanted to play Pappy and Harriet's. We finally got to do that back in June. And for people who are unfamiliar with Pappy and Harriet's, it's in the high desert near Joshua Tree. Pioneer Town is it's a very small town. It's almost a little too generous to call it a town. But it was built in the 40s to be a living set for Westerns. And there are still businesses located behind storefronts that look like they are blacksmith shops or, you know, leather tanners and whatnot. And the anchor business for Pioneer Town is this sprawling venue called Pappy and Harriet's, and it's a combination barbecue joint / tourist destination / biker bar / concert venue / old west outpost. And we played there back in June with Dan Broder, who was playing guitar for the band at the time and played with us for the bulk of 2009 for all of 2009 and much of this year. There's a magic that that attaches itself to that place. I never have an ordinary experience when I go to Pappy and Harriet's. It's just a place for drifters and folks who want to live off the grid to gather and listen to music. We had a fantastic experience when we were playing there. The night before, we were staying at a place not too far from there called Rimrock Ranch. And just the band was staying there, or so we thought. And we were sitting around the fire at night picking guitars. And out of this house walks this lean older guy with a Martin in his hand. And he asks if we're pickers, and we said yes, and he sat down and played some of the most incredible acoustic music I've ever heard. Well, it turns out he's a world-class pedal steel player, and he just happens to have his rig in the car. So we hand him our song list. He knows 90% of the set, and long story short, we picked up this world-class pedal steel player for our gig the next night. His name's Charlie Wallace. Some of your readers, I'm sure, know him. And, that's just the kind of stuff that happens at Pappy and Harriet's. You're plucking your guitar around a fire and you pick up a stellar pedal steel player who, just happens to have his gear with him and will join you on stage the next night. There's a special place in my heart for Pappy and Harriet's.
At Poway, you not only are involved into the day-to-day operations of phone calls like the ones we've talked about, but you're also deciding a season. How are the acts selected? What are you looking for? Is it based on prior seasonal feedback from the audience, or what's the whole spectrum for getting these bands?
Well, you know, it's probably not dissimilar to the band approach, and I don't want to put the cart before the horse here because the band came long after my tenure in Poway, but our charge from the city of Poway, and I want to clarify, I work for the Poway Center for the Performing Arts Foundation, which is an independent, not-for-profit created by the city of Poway to book professional performances at the center. The center gets used for a variety of things, school groups, community groups, so on. But the city, and I think this is incredibly progressive, years ago the city decided, well, we want it to be available to the full spectrum of use, community groups, school groups, and also to be a portal for national acts to come and perform for inland North County. So we have a charge from the city to put together a performance series that serves the entire community. That's a tall order because the community is disparate. We have seniors, we have youth, we have baby boomers, we have Gen Xers, we have people in their peak earning years, we have people who are retirees. So our charge is to try and present an eclectic mix of shows that represent the full spectrum of the performing arts. So we always try to have some theater in the mix. We do very well with live concerts. I know you've been up there for several. Family programming looms large in our mix as well. Okay, so how do we pick the shows? I get asked that a lot. And the short answer is you start your year with kind of a wish list. All right, here are the people I'd love to bring. And then that's when it becomes work. You start talking to agents, you see who's available, you see who you can afford, you see who's going to be in your part of the world at a time that works for your schedule. You're always looking backward at shows that did well in your community before, but at the same time, our mission really isn't just to wring every dollar we can out of ticket sales. The return on investment for a not-for-profit arts presenter has as much to do with impact and smiles in the aisles as it does with the bottom line. There's a reason we're a not-for-profit. There's a reason why we're backed by individuals and corporations, and that's because they believe in the mission of what we do. So, was that vague enough for you? I mean, basically, you start with a bunch of artists you'd like to put on stage. You try to keep the mix balanced so that there's something for as many people as possible. You'll see a little bit of my own tastes emerging from time to time. I mean, you saw Chris Hillman and Herb Peterson kicking off our season this year. Obviously, that's an act that's near and dear to my own heart. We put him on stage with the Yves Celis Band, who's a local act that I think is phenomenal, but particularly well-suited for a performing arts center environment. After that, we followed it up with a pair of Celtic fiddlers who have twice performed at the Poway Center before, Natalie McMaster and Danelle Leahy. That act had some history with the center. We knew they were going to do well. We knew we had a built-in audience for them because they'd performed there before. Coming up in February, we're doing a Buddy Holly tribute show. It's the 53rd anniversary, I think, of the death of Buddy Holly.
1959.
So somebody do the math for me. Anyway, it's in February, so we're coming up on that anniversary. So we thought, let's honor Buddy with a tribute show. After that, we have classical music with the Romeros, the
San Diego
royal dynasty of classical guitar. And then we conclude the season with the fresh from Broadway play called The 39 Steps, which is a stage adaptation of an old Hitchcock film. I'm particularly excited about that one because the play itself features 150 characters performed by four actors.
Wow.
So it's what we call a quick change comedy, where you'll have two actors on stage dressed as British bobbies 1 minute, and then they'll dash off stage and come back as the ugliest farm wives you've ever seen 30 seconds later. Just within a three-month period, we've got Buddy Holly, classical guitar, a fresh from Broadway show, and then we've also got a pair of family performances in the mix, Barrio Girl, which is a new family drama by the director of In the Heights, about a young girl whose mother is deployed in Iraq, and she takes on this superhero persona to fight crime in the barrio. So,
and if I can finish on my troubadour reference, what's great when I get an opportunity to go up there, we look at the last 2 years. Chris Hillman, Herb Peterson, Leon Redbone,
mm-hmm.
and then John Sebastian, Roger McGuinn.
Tom Rush.
Mm-hmm. And now these are artists that would come out of the pages of the Troubadour.
Leo Kottke.
And we go up there and we find a pretty full house, mm-hmm. for people who don't get played on the radio, mm-hmm. a great deal anymore. In the case of McGuinn, he's selling his stuff online because he's pretty much had it with record labels.
Yeah.
And so it's great knowing that even though they're no longer the flavor of the month by whoever dictates what popular culture is in, mm-hmm. 2010. There is an audience that will come. If Michael puts it on, they will come.
You know, our hope, of course, is that people, when they get our season listing, will open up that brochure and say, okay, I've heard of this one, and I've heard of that one. I haven't heard of these three, but they always do great stuff, so I'm going to go. And that's kind of the dream of any performing arts center, is to cultivate this sense of trust between a center and your audience, where you're handpicking shows that you know they'll like, even if they haven't heard of these talents before, that hopefully there's enough of a trust going on that they'll want to come. And for me, it's a particularly timely mission, because it's so easy to sit at your computer and poke your friends and read their Facebook updates and read your email and feel like you're kind of connected with your peers. But, as I mentioned earlier, there's just nothing quite like sitting shoulder to shoulder with your neighbors and watching a show and being able to walk out in the lobby and talk about a shared show. a shared cultural experience, something you both sat and watched together. I mean, you and I and all the Troubadour readers probably know this already, that there's nothing like a live performance. It's unique. It only happens once, and then it's gone forever. And digital culture doesn't give us that. We're all watching the same damn YouTube clip.
So, Michael kind of spends his time on both sides of the music business fence. Talent buyer, if you will, and a talented guy who's out to get gigs, just like the rest of us. You know, it's a unique perspective, being able to see both sides like that. But how does it tie together? Does it tie together?
We, in our sort of pre-talks, you brought up a very interesting point. You work for the Poway Performing Arts Center, and you're also a active musician in the San Diego music scene. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned in occupations, one in work and play, that both are essentially curatorial. And how is that? You work for a theater group in Poway, and you're plunking guitar around different bars in San Diego.
The idea really was to form a cover band that I liked, a cover band that performed not the kind of tried and true canon of cover songs that we've all heard a million times, but to try and work up songs that I liked, songs that I would feel some pride in introducing an audience to. So in that regard, I saw it as sort of a curatorial exercise, almost like hanging paintings in a museum. When you go to a museum or an art gallery, you're usually going there with the mindset that you are going to be exposed to something new. And that very much parallels my day job, where as the executive director of the Poway Center for the Performing Arts Foundation, a big part of my job is to put together a performing arts series. And that that involves some degree of, quote-unquote, giving the audience what they want, but there is a curatorial component to that as well. We see that space on stage as something of a sacred space. It's a portal. It's a way for us to bring artists into that community that might not otherwise perform there. It's a way to expose our audience to talents that they might not otherwise have a chance to see. So there is still that, you know, that feel of hanging paintings on a wall, if you will, and inviting people to come and see them and respond to them and have a shared cultural experience. And it wasn't something that was real obvious to me at first. I was just sort of doing both gigs independent of one another. And as I went on through both my professional and my musical careers, I realized, wow, there's a lot of similarity in what I'm doing here. I'm basically being asked to use my tastes and my history as a filter and present something of worth to the community. So not to be too high-minded about what is at the end of the day just a cover band for fun and an excuse for people to get up and shake their tails. But it was always gratifying to me to feel like I was, doing something a little bigger than just playing some songs.
Well, that's it for this month's edition of the Troubadour Tapes podcast. My name's Jeff Berkeley. Special thanks to Liz and Will and everybody over at the San Diego Troubadour. And special thanks to Steve Thorne and Michael Rennie for letting us in on their conversation. We'll see you next time.
The Troubadour Tapes.
One, two, three.
Two and three.
Berkeley.
Berkeley.
Berkeley sound.
If I could talk.
Berkeley.
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 BerkeleySound.com.
Berkeley Sound.